Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Christopher D. Bryan, Attorney Registration Number 35522, on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Mark Allen Kittle. We're here today because there was an adverse possession case that went to trial in Pitkin County District Court in March of 2010. And in that case, there was a half acre of property that was in dispute. My client had adversely possessed the property since 1978 through the present and brought suit to quiet title. Now, the trial court got many things right in that decision. It found that Kittle had adversely possessed the property. It found that there was exclusive use. It found that there was hostility and claim of right. And it found, at least for the long property that's in that Y-shaped portion of one of the diagrams, including in the briefs, that he had actual use. But the trial court made two mistakes with respect to the numerous elements of adverse possession. First, it found that Mr. Kittle's adverse possession was not open and notorious because St. Jude's could not see the adverse use from its property across the river. And the second mistake was that it was not continuous and uninterrupted based on an alleged offer to sell made by Mr. Kittle's father several years before. Both of those, as a matter of law, are incorrect. And in fact, the trial court's findings and conclusions of law with respect to the other elements are in favor of Mr. Kittle and have not been cross-appealed.
Sorry to interrupt. Sure. Now, let me start with the actual use element.
Sure.
The judge's findings seem to me to say, I don't believe your client. But let me see if I get this right. Okay. Sorting out the use element only, there's no question from the findings that the Y-shaped grassy area was used.
Right.
Her dispute had to do with the wooded areas.
Correct.
And she, as I understand it, said those areas were not used.
That is what she found, and we believe she applied the wrong standard. So there's really two different issues here on appeal. There's, if you find that I'm right about open and notorious and continuous and uninterrupted, then Mark Kittle will adversely possess the Y-shaped area, because no one's appealed or disputed the actual finding of that. Now, if you go that way, then it's still possible that you could say, yes, we agree that adverse possession should lie to Mr. Kittle with respect to the Y-shaped grassy area, but not as to...
So it would sever the...
Right. It's possible that adversely possess part of a parcel, but not the entire parcel. Now, we do assert, based on the case law that's been in Colorado for numerous years and is the majority trend in every state and jurisdiction, that to occupy those wooded areas and those more brushy areas, that you don't have to actually occupy every square inch or a square foot of that property. You just have to use it in the normal, natural way of the characteristics.
And what is that?
That would be exactly what they were used for. They were used for occasional use for fishing and accessing the river, for storing things like junk and refrigerators and housewares and deer targets.
Well, who put the junk there?
My client.
Well, she didn't believe you.
No, Your Honor.
That's why I say that's what it seems like. Okay. The judge said, Wagner, I believe, Kittle, I don't.
Right. Well, as far as she was talking about, that was just as one small issue. That was as to the stacking of some firewood, not the piling of brush that has been proven and undisputed to have occurred for decades.
And the firewood was placed on the wooded area. Sorry to interrupt, but you don't have much time. I don't want to...
I'm going to clarify this for you, though, because although she said, I don't believe that the firewood was stacked there, she didn't dispute his use of the myriad other uses that he had of those adjacent areas.
She said no clearing and grubbing.
Right, clearing and grubbing was somewhat of a problematic term, because when people think clearing, they think you clear cut some trees and had basically wiped out all the trees. That's not what happened. He did seasonally clear, and his tenants testified to this. Another fact was...
Who he? Kittle?
Mr. Kittle, yes, and his tenants. And there's
I'm going to stop you here for a minute. I understand what you're talking about typically of, you know, clearing means to cut down all the trees. He never alleged he did that.
Right.
He alleged that he did something else, including cleaning up the brush.
Correct.
When she found that he had not done any clearing and grubbing, are you saying that she was saying, no, you didn't cut down all the trees, or no, I don't believe you, I don't have sufficient evidence that you went in there and cleared out the brush?
The former, Your Honor. Because the clearing and grubbing came from a survey done by Soquist Engineering, and that surveyor used the term clearing and grubbing, which admittedly.
That's the survey that prepared the big.
Correct.
Flat picture, diagram.
The survey, yes. And so when he said cleared and grubbed, that was misleading, and I think the trial court got hung up on that, but didn't look to the many other uses that Mr. Kittle has done in that area since 1978 that his tenants have done continuously through the period of adversity. So even if you don't, if you're not inclined to say, yes, you've adversely possessed, actually used those two cleared and grubbed brushy areas, there can be no doubt that Mr. Kittle is entitled, at the very least, to adverse possession of the Y-shaped lawn area. There he did put in a lawn. He manicured it and mowed it and kept it there. There was a picnic table there. There were gardens. There was a river access, volleyball nets, fire pits, horseshoe pits. Anything that you or I would do with our backyard, Mr. Kittle and his tenants did with that area. And in fact, in 1980, he built a deck on his trailer that jutted out across the property line. And then in 1990, an addition, a permanent addition, was built onto that. That too extends over the property line.
Does the grassy area include the corner where the they would fish? There's a picture of a crate, I think, in that corner area. It's grassy.
There were two parts there that were in the quote cleared and grubbed areas to either side of the direct backyard. Those fishing points were in the cleared and grubbed areas, although they were cleared out. So that,
and how did they get to that?
And we under rule 47, we took the judge on a site visit, and we actually walked the area from the backyard, from the trailer, to that point so that she could see the ways that Mr. Moore and others who had the permission of Mr. Kittle accessed the river through those areas. And can you tell the footpaths?
Wooded areas.
Yes, but you could also access the river directly back in that Y-shaped grassy area. And that's where a lot of rafting activity happened. You would put in and take out there. And there was a picnic table there. And that's not too much in dispute. The only thing that the judge got wrong with respect to the grassy area is the open and notorious claim, which we believe is a matter of law, just can't lie, because that means if someone owned property in another county different from which they lived, but they couldn't see it from their own homestead, then it wouldn't be open and notorious. But that's not what open and notorious means in the centuries of adverse possession jurisprudence. What open and notorious means is that it's sufficient enough to put a reasonably diligent homeowner on notice that someone's adversely using their land. But here it's undisputed that there was no reasonable diligence by St. Jude's. They had testified, their representative testified at trial, that he hadn't even stepped foot on this property since 1968. Now, he could have...
If they want the land preserved in its pristine form, is that a reasonable use, is to leave it lie and not go visit it, not look it over?
It's not, Your Honor. Even if someone wants to leave a property in its natural state or its wild wilderness habitat, you still have a duty as a property owner to exercise reasonable diligence.
Well, obviously that didn't happen since grass was planted or...
Right, exactly. And that would be clear indicia that anyone who visited, that wait a minute, this is not in its natural habitat. Someone's using my property. They didn't do that, and so the court misapplied the legal standards. The court...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor? The court just applied the wrong test as to open and notorious. She thought that that means you have to be able to see it from across the river where you live, and that just has no legal support. So I think that's relatively clear in the cases cited and in the briefing. The second issue that she got...
what you've argued so far is, at very least, the lawn area he should prevail on and get adverse title to, he ought to get title to, and that it's possible that the wooded areas that he wouldn't get title to. I know you're not conceding that. So what of the court's findings would support our conclusion that the court erred when it did not award him the wooded area?
Well, because she, I believe, simply didn't understand that to have actual adverse use of property doesn't mean that you have to have cleared all the forested area, or all the trees. And she saw for herself, and there was undisputed testimony trial, that there was storage areas, there was piling of brush, there were pathways that were used. Kids played here. One of the two kids, Matthew and Sarah, the tenants in the 90s.
There's evidence of
Yes.
We don't have findings, and we can't make findings based on the evidence. And so what I'm looking at is what findings did the court make that would support us to say, based on your findings, Judge, you erred when you did not award the forested areas?
The findings there, Your Honor, would be that she did not believe, she did find that there was use there. She didn't believe that that use was sufficient enough for adverse possession to lie. It wasn't sufficiently actual. And so what we've done in the briefing is show that under Doty and under Anderson, under Smith and under Holland, you don't have to use every square inch. You don't have to make improvements. That the land only need be used as it would typically be used, given the limitations and characteristics of that property.
But it has to be continuous and uninterrupted.
I guess the question is, how much use does it have to be?
Right. If he were to be using it to cross to go fishing once a year, would that be enough?
Probably not, Your Honor. But here we had testimony that there was fishing 24 or more times a year. Well, the line is a case by case. I can't tell you exactly what it is, but it's enough to exert dominion over the property, and that's what happened here. Because the ordinary use was, I mean, even the record title owner said that typical use was to just leave it lie, just let it be. Well, Mr. Kittle did much more than that. He cleared brush, he cleared deadwood, and felled cottonwood.
That's evidence that he did that, but we don't have findings that he did that.
Well, to that extent, then, Her Honor erred in not making those findings, but there is undisputed evidence in the record. There's record support for finding of adverse possession of those areas. I see that my time's winding down, so I'd like to reserve the balance for rebuttal, and I'll also be happy to take any questions upon rebuttal about the issue of continuous and uninterrupted.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, Greg Cucarola, number 1474, St. Jude's Company. With me at counsel table is paralegal Heidi DiMercurio here for the purpose of locating anything in the record the court might know about. And an associate of mine is Rose Van Hoffwagen here, strictly for the purpose if she might observe, please. Judges, our response today will be in two parts. First of all, we'll look at the district court's findings, why they were correct, why she found as such, why the law was applied correctly, and secondly, we'll look at what would be the ramifications of a reversal based on their argument, based on what they're asking for, either full or in part, based on the law only. First of all, we look at the standards applied here. We note that the Schoenherr versus Campbell says that determination of a question of adverse possession is a question of fact to be done by the trial court here. That's exactly what she did. First of all, secondly, look at page 2 of her findings. The law on this in Colorado is that the framework here under Palmer Ranch requires a true belief in ownership. At page 2 of her findings, the first thing she found, the framework of the law, the framework of the findings and the opinions, Mr. Kittle nor his relatives never, ever, ever, at any time, ever had a true belief in ownership here. Never.
And evidence that
no judge, no judge.
Nothing in the record from Kittle's side saying we believe this was our land.
No. In fact, all to the contrary, and we'll note that. Adverse possession, judges, is about proving the elements of your case. He just didn't prove his case. Adverse possession is you have to prove each and every element for 18 years. It's not about expressing your dislike about how your neighbor uses his land and why. Why do we have these things? Because we're taking land, and here are very valuable lands, family lands. We're taking lands from somebody who owned them and giving them to somebody who didn't pay for them. And we're all lawyers here. We're lawyers, but the man on the street, what's the first thing he would say if you asked him about adverse possession, if he knew anything? Oh, you got to do something for 18 years.
Oh, no, let me stop you there. Sorry to interrupt. What is the effect of, as I understand the record, your client never walked on this land for 18 plus years?
You know, Judge,
I mean, there is a picture of a tree in the middle of the grassy area that's a little tiny tree, and then a picture later on showing that to be a very tall, big tree, evidencing a long period of time where there is a grassy area. And the same question I had of opposing counsel, if your client's position is to preserve the land in its natural state, and that's the intent to put it into a trust to do so, it would seem incumbent to make sure that the land is remaining in that state. And I'm trying to figure out what's the effect of
No, Judge, it's a good question. Let's assume. Look at this record. It's assumed that they would have gone over based on the representations of this record. Would these kindly people, these neighbors in this record, have chased him off the grass? You have to look at the record here.
Well, no, they had access to the land by an easement. That's the gate that's grown over, right?
No, Judge, that easement was not used and never disputed.
Now, well, but they did have access to their plot of land, is what I'm saying.
I think so, but the trial court specifically found they had no reason to go over there. And if I just might show you figuratively, if I took this blank sheet of paper, this represented St. Jude's Ranch, and I bent this little corner over here over, that's the disputed land. And right here is the wide growing Fork River that passes through and cuts the parcels apart, heavily wooded, all over the subject, the ranch, as was said in the case, so dense, so thick, that a chipmunk could get through. Not an easy area to access for someone in their 70s with bad knees, but let alone anyone else. And the trial court did everything that Mr. Kittle asked her to do. She went over, she took the view, she climbed the high boulders, she looked every place he wanted. She went through the thickets, the brush, the weeds, the fences. She stood on the high boulders and specifically found there was no notice here. There was no notice of his lawn, his picnic table, any of his activities. And she specifically looked at the foundation of his claim.
So, again, I'm going to fire a lot of questions because this is very record intensive. The test is one of reasonable diligence. Is that correct?
No, Judge.
For the landowner, for the title, then what is the test? It has to be in sight from
Judge,
the property?
If you please, the test is Trask. Notice to the world, and that is exactly what this trial court applied. The standard is notice to the world. She went on the view, and she found specifically after looking at every single thing that he wanted her to look at, you couldn't see it from the north, the south.
But notice, it's not the exercise of reasonable diligence.
No, Judge, it's not about fault on the landowner. There's no law about fault on the landowner.
Suggesting fault.
Your elements of the case. And there was no reason to, first of all, there was no notice, no true belief, no 18 years met even close. And it's not about fault, it's about notice. And that's the standard she applied. I'm sorry.
Well, we're not talking about fault either. The question is open and notorious, and what does it take for it to be open and notorious? And it seems that the trial court here said in order for it to be open and notorious, it had to be visible from outside the property. And it seems to me that the issue here is, well, what does that phrase mean? Is it sufficient that it is openly used, it is obviously used, and the owner of such property was on notice because it was being used? Are you saying that open and notorious requires proof that the owner knew? Because that's what I'm hearing you argue.
Judge, under the legal standard, open and notorious requires notice to the world. It's not notice as to what Mr. Kittle thought was notice. It's not notice to what St. Jude's thought was notice. It's notice to the world. And there was no notice to the world, not from any side, not from the aerial photography, and that's why counsel engaged aerial photography. Because if you think, look at his Exhibit 1. She specifically found that everything he alleged to be cleared and grubbed on his Exhibit 1 was false.
not only looking at the evidence, but going out. He told her there were 15 to 20 stumps showing in the lawn. She went out on the view, found not a stump. There was no notice to St. Jude's. They couldn't see the lawn anywhere. And you would think, if he had done all these things, you could see him from the air. The record confirms you couldn't see him from the air. Now, we've talked about notice, but here's a very important issue. Let's talk about another kind of notice. The notice you get that when a neighbor calls you up and he says, I want to buy your land. And he calls you 10 years later and he says, I want to trade your land. Would you trade your land on my side of the river for mine on your side of the river? And he calls 10 years later and he says, let's swap. Peace for peace, and that's the exact term. What notice does that give you? Does it make you dash in your car over and look? Does it make you swim the river? Or go over and bang on the door and say, hey, what are you doing behind the trailer? Oh, I'm not trying to be funny. This goes to notice. This is a very serious matter that raises this far, far up and beyond the level of the notice here.
Are you saying that asking the possibility of indication
not only an indication, Judge, a representation. And this relates to 18 years. The man on the street thinks of 18 years. You take any segment of time you want here, any single one. He never came close to 18 years. He lived there only 18 or 12 years, and he left. And in 1990, he reset the clock back to zero because he made a notice to trade. In 2000, he found that he made a notice to swap. Then he reset the clock. In 02, by his very hand, he drew trial exhibit R10. And what does that show? The trial court told us an intent to tear down the trailer, all the encroachments. He knew the property line at all times. He never intended to have anything encroaching, no lawn, no anything. That's specific notice. And on, he made offers in 07, told people it was not his. What is the impact of that kind of thing? The impact is not to make you want to go over. And the final list that he has given us, yes, of the things he did, we can look and we can say the same thing that the trial court said. It was mere occupancy. Look at the Tacola case. What do we call that in Colorado? We call it mere occupancy. They used to call it squatting. Not a nice word, but I didn't invent it. What's mere occupancy? Well, it's handy. And look at all the things that he did. It was just handy. It was convenient to go out by the river and have a beer and look around. But that's not adverse possession. That's not adverse possession. It was just easy. Now, quickly, in summary here, let's look at the ramifications of what he wants, a reversal based on what they want. Well, the first thing you would see is what? If you can't buy your neighbor's land after offering over and over and over to buy it, just sue him for adverse possession. Leverage down the claim, put him to the misery of litigation, and buy it for 10 cents on the dollar. Now, everybody knows that. Anybody can see that here, but let's look deeper. Look deeper at what really would be the message sent on a reversal on the lawn. First of all, there was no true belief in owning the lawn, no notice of the lawn, and a...
Excuse me, you started your argument that one of the basic requirements, or the first question a court has to answer, is belief that the action is hostile and will acquire the property, right? I mean, that was
true belief in ownership.
True belief.
That's the law, Pomerange.
Right. Now, did the court base its decision on that issue?
Yes.
That's and where is that?
Page 2 of the order, sir. Page 2 of the order where the trial court said, if you look, I'll get it here. Here she said, heading, plaintiff's knowledge that the subject property was not his.
You say there was no evidence of that.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. And look at Smith versus
Hayes. I'm misunderstanding. You're saying there's no evidence to support the court's findings?
There is every bit of evidence to support the court's findings. He never, ever at any time had a true good faith belief that he owned this, ever. Neither did his family.
But the court found hostile, right?
No, if you look at the last page 8, she found not hostile because there was no notice and there was no true intent. Now, we're getting into things that I let's look at page 10. It was not open and notorious, she found, under the open and notorious heading. And it was not obvious, no notice to Mr. Cerise. Not open and notorious, and not hostile, we believe, either. You have to look at the true intent of the order.
Well, her order on page 8, hostile intent under claim of right, the evidence shows a plaintiff and his tenants use this land as if it was owned by a plaintiff from 1978 when he acquired the subject property. They've used it for picnics, sporadic gardening, and to fish. The court finds that the hostile intent and claim of right elements have been satisfied.
Judge, perhaps the language could have been better. But this is a difficult area of law to understand. And you read the cases, they're short. It's very difficult to determine what is hostile. But look at Trask, that was clarified. Hostility in actual possession require notice. If you don't have notice, there's no hostility and no actual possession.
You don't have to have actual notice, right? You just have to behave in such a way that with due diligence, the record owner would have notice. It doesn't require actual notice, does it?
No, Judge. I'm sorry, and I don't mean to be disrespectful. The standard is notice to the world. This element of law is not based on fault of the landowner. It's about you proving your case. You see, Mr. Kittle just didn't prove his case. She gave him every chance in the world, did everything he wanted, but he missed it by a far mark. Not only notice, he never met the 18 years. Under any time span you pick, he never came close. He never had a true good faith belief ever. He owned it.
What is the belief? I guess that's what the question that I started by opening my questioning. What is the belief that the adverse possessor has to have that you say is missing? And that's what I'm having problems understanding, what that belief is.
You know, Judge, that's why the standard of review here is deference to the trial court's findings, because she made that determination based on credibility, weight of the evidence, and things of that nature.
You're still the answer to my question. Belief of what?
In true ownership. The adverse possessor under this lineage of case law, Smith, Palmer, but no adverse possessor has ever prevailed in Colorado without a finding by the trial court or a notation that the party actually believed he truly owned the land.
So you're saying that there's no evidence here that Mr. Kittle ever believed that that was his property?
But Judge, that's not only there's no evidence, but there's that specific finding. Page two. His very family, his very own witnesses testified that he never had a true good faith belief. That's in concert with his always making offers to buy. You don't make offers to buy if you have a good faith belief, do you? You don't make offers, you don't draw exhibit R10 showing you're going to tear down the encroachments and abide by the property line if you have a true good faith belief in ownership. And the swaps don't show good true faith belief. That is very specific, and that is the framework, the linchpin, if you will, on page 2.
To summarize then, what you're saying is that Mr. Kittle had to actually believe he had title to that land.
It's
belief in ownership.
Well, yes. Yes, that's the law.
Okay, so I understand you've said that, but now I'm saying, so does that equate to that he had to believe that he was, under the law, that he was the owner of that land, that he held title to that land?
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
Without that, any trespasser can file a lawsuit. Thank you.
Just
we can clear up a couple of things. This is reviewed de novo because this is the application of law to historical facts. That's what the court has that review. It's not abuse of discretion. I think that's made clear in the briefs. As to Mr. Cucurella's discussion of the true intent or subjective belief, things like that, that's not the issue here. There's a couple things to remember. One is that this case is being tried under the pre-July 1, 2008 version of the statute, because it was commenced before then. Adverse possession had vested before July 1st. The legislature did make some changes. They changed the standard from preponderance of the evidence to clear and convincing for evidence. They did insert a subjective intent standard, but that doesn't apply to this case. And they also required
Are you saying that the argument, which is based on belief of Mr. Kittle, didn't apply because that would only apply to the later statute? Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. That would only apply to adverse possession invested after July 1st, 2008, by the very words of the amended statute.
Could you answer this question? What's the effect of the 1990 offer from Kittle's father?
It is of no moment.
Why?
For three reasons. One, Wyland Kittle, the father, had no authority to transact business or represent or be the agent of Mr. Kittle's adverse possession claimed property, which he hadn't made the claim for yet because it wasn't ripe yet. Secondly, if you read the record, there's no indication he's talking about this half acre of property adjacent to Mr. Kittle's title property. Wyland owns property that is upriver, and in fact, St. Jude's has increasingly needed to come near that area for its water rights, to impose concrete beams and drilling rigs and posts, and that might have been the property they were talking about, but because these offhanded remarks never really came to fruition, there was no firm offer to swap or sell. All we have is hearsay testimony or secondhand testimony about it. We don't have anything in writing that showed that there was a firm offer to swap or sell, so we don't even know if they're talking about that. Now, third, and this is most critical for this panel, is that even if Wyland had authority to negotiate for an offer to sell or swap, and even if the subject property was that which the offer to swap or sell was about, it wouldn't matter because under Colorado case law, under Hain, under Schoenherr, under Ockmulgee, recognition of someone else's title strengthens your adverse possession claim. It doesn't weaken it. And that is what the distinguishing factors from Sogelke and Atkins are. Sogelke and Atkins was decided by the Colorado Supreme Court in 1960. And there was a disclaimer of interest. There, the initial entry upon land was permissive. It was under a lease. You don't have any of those circumstances here. I've tried to very clearly lay those distinguishing characteristics out in my opening and reply brief. You'll note that in the answer brief, St. Jude doesn't even engage that legal.
And what about the trial court's findings with respect to Exhibit R10? In 2002, plaintiff drew Exhibit R10. His drawing shows that the modular units would have been fully on his property. This indicates that plaintiff knew in 2002 that the subject property was not his.
Again, Your Honor, I think that's of no moment. The fact that the property was actually over the property land, the property line, the addition, and then before that, the deck that was built in 1980, they'd only vested by 2002. 1978 plus 18 years means it vested by 1996. They'd already been vesting. So put that aside for one moment. It still is of no moment that Exhibit R10, because Mr. Kittle was required to meet the elements as existed when he brought suit, not the revised and admittedly much more difficult statute that is in place for adverse possession of vests after July 1, 2008. Thank you, Your Honor.
Kittle against St. Jude's Company now is submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you, counsel, for your assistance with this difficult case.